From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, federal and state officials give Flint residents a report card on their water.
I hope that federal and state officials especially understand that even when they're telling the truth and they're being clear, it's going to take time before the people of Flint can trust that.
Why you'll see more trucks, SUVs, and crossovers than ever at the auto show.
We're in the midst of probably one of the most important transformations that we have seen in the auto industry in decades.
Michigan's Democrats focus on a new goal.
To say it's critically important that Democrats win the governor's office in 2018, I think would be an understatement.
And we'll talk about possible ripple effects as Macy's, Sears, and Kmart announce store closings. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside on this very gray, wet January Thursday. I'm Cynthia Canty. With Republicans continuing their dominance of state government, not to mention significant election defeats in November, the state Democratic Party has a lot of work to do. But that does not mean all is lost.
The fact that Secretary Clinton was able to carry the popular vote by almost 3 million votes, I think, suggests that, you know, while we may be down, we're certainly not out.
We'll speak with the head of Michigan's Democratic Party, Brandon Dillon, later in the hour. Also, despite a scientific consensus that Flint's water quality is improving, people in Flint are still skeptical.
The message I take from that is, yeah, we heard this before, and we are still drinking bottled water.
We will get Congressman Dan Kildee's take on yesterday's town hall meeting about water in Flint. But first, there has been something besides the shiny new cars, SUVs, and trucks grabbing attention this week at the North American International Auto Show in Detroit. That something is the uncertain future for the auto industry under incoming President Donald Trump. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us now. And Daniel, I think the quote that you gave us from Sergio Marchionne of Fiat Chrysler kind of hit the nail on the head. He said, this is new territory for most of us. None of us have had a tweeting president.
Ain't that the truth? And so it continues. Yesterday in his press conference, he went after the pharmaceutical industry and the drug shares just tanked. You know, it's one thing after another. But, you know, what's remarkable is Trump and his tweeting about the industry, whether intentionally or not, displaying a pretty incredible ignorance about how the modern industry works, and seems to demonstrate also the fact that he really doesn't necessarily care. I mean, he's taking credit for investment decisions that GM, Ford, and FCA have made since the middle of December, all of which, according to one ranking executive at one of those three companies, were probably made on average 2 to 4 years ago, and they certainly weren't made in the last month, but they're announcing them now, and the president-elect's taking credit for them.
I get the sense from reading your columns this week, the execs are very leery about speaking publicly because they're afraid of unleashing another Trump tweet storm.
I think that's right. You know, Sergio Marchionne was a little more outspoken, but he didn't say a whole lot beyond saying, you know, we'll adjust. This guy's the president of the United States, and to embellish that a little bit, I mean, he essentially said, look, the American people elected this guy. We've got to deal with him, whoever that president is, and whatever that president's policies are, and then we're going to decide. But until we get some clarity on what's actually going to happen, we really can't do a whole lot. Carlos Ghosn of Renault Nissan said the same thing. I would say Ford Motor Company has probably been the most proactive. Chairman Bill Ford has spent some time on the phone with Trump, and I think has found him to be accessible and willing to listen and also willing to learn. That's, I think, in the positive category.
And then, of course, Mary Barra is going to be on his advisory council.
She is, but General Motors, I think, in general, I would say, tends to be far more quiet about these kinds of things. I think their view is keep your head down, work things behind the scenes, and don't, as I like to say, don't give him a club to beat us with.
Now, as for Mr. Trump's pledge to revise or even scrap NAFTA, Talk about your column today. Why is that less job-friendly than the president-elect thinks it'll be?
Well, the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, which is connected to the industry, but is also very respected in terms of being a think tank that really understands the industry, has a report out that says that they think it would cost, if he were to repeal NAFTA or establish large tariffs as high as 35% on Mexican-made goods, that could result in the loss of 31,000 jobs in the United States. They also go on to say that Michigan's, particularly Southeast Michigan, would be hit very hard because it exports a lot of products both to Canada and especially to Mexico, and that there could be some knock-on effects there.
Why would we lose those jobs?
Because the expectation is that Mexico could retaliate and erect tariffs as well. Then the other possibility is you go from having the North American market to becoming the U.S. market, and then building and producing products in Mexico doesn't become cost-effective. Therefore, manufacturers are going to be looking for other places to source products and parts.
And those places might be where?
In Asia. Likely in Asia. So somebody's got to pay for the tariffs, right? And as a general proposition, the old saw about business taxes is that businesses don't pay business taxes. The end consumers pay the business tax. So when business taxes are high, products tend to be more expensive. That's how a market economy works. And unless this president can repeal the laws of market economics, companies are going to go elsewhere to find production sites and sources for things.
With the possibility of at least 31,000 U.S. automotive and parts jobs being lost, we also have, for American consumers, they're going to pay a price if people just want to buy the car they want to buy.
Right. And there is an argument, and I've seen it advanced actually some comments on the column this morning already, of saying, well, you know what, if this is what people want, let them have it. Go ahead, repeal NAFTA and see what happens. Companies are going to do what they have to do, and there's going to be some knock-on effects. I don't think there's any question about it. And exactly what those are would remain to be seen. But, you know, after January 20th, when he actually becomes president, do you really think this is going to be the top one or two issues on his plate? I'd be a little surprised if it is. But the other thing that needs to be pointed out is he's got a number of people in his cabinet, prospective members of his cabinet, who I think the automakers are looking to as people who will bring some understanding and some sanity to this discussion. Elaine Chao is the Treasury Secretary nominee, ran the Labor Department for President Bush. Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary, is very involved in recapitalizing of the steel industry in the United States, has a great reputation with the United Steelworkers. And, of course, Vice President Mike Pence, governor of Indiana, which is a major auto-producing state, one of the largest as a percentage of its economy. I think manufacturing has more manufacturing in it, maybe even than Michigan.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. And if you miss any part of today's show, it's very easy to find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast. You'll find the link.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
2016 is now history. And as we move into the new year, the next idea's Jeff DeGraff is continuing his passionate pursuit of, well, whatever's next. He already has some thoughts about what trends and innovations we might see or not in 2017.
To start, can we stop with all the hype about self-driving cars? Yes, they're on the way, but not in the new year. Autonomous vehicles will indeed be part of the transportation landscape in the near future, but it will take decades to develop the infrastructure necessary to get these technologies in place. The more immediate applications for autonomous vehicles will be in freight management and delivery. Given how the volume of packages overwhelmed both UPS and FedEx this past holiday season, you can expect to see an autonomous truck coming soon to a driveway near you, though likely not this year. What will become closer to the norm in 2017 is ride-sharing. For the past several years, city dwellers of all ages have been using Uber and Lyft to get around. Many of the younger ones don't even own cars and don't plan to. Ride-sharing has now found its way to mid-sized cities and towns. This means city planners across the nation will have to rethink traffic flows, taxi stands, and projections for parking spaces and ramps. These right-now services are not only changing the way we get around, but also the way our businesses work. Uberization has become part of our vocabulary. It means using technology to connect a loose federation of free agents to provide just-in-time services. Uberization is creating diseconomies of scale, because the network connects seekers and solvers without all the overhead. Bigger is no longer better. It's pure capitalism with all the advantages and disadvantages. When everyone has to compete for everything, everywhere, every day, products and services are cheaper. But that's at the expense of stable jobs and steady wages. Some new innovations will have to address basic needs like water and food. Here in the Great Lakes Basin, the management and protection of water will become an increasingly contentious issue as commercial interests like Nestle are allowed to extract increasing amounts of water from our lakes and watersheds, while at the same time the aging infrastructure of our cities is making it more difficult to deliver safe water to residents. Given our location amid 90% of all the surface fresh water in the United States and our responsibility as stewards of this natural resource, significant investments in water infrastructure must happen. This will be an opportunity to develop and implement innovative technologies to replace those currently in use, many of which are typically a half a century old. Finally, there are a number of global issues on the horizon that will warrant and attract innovations. For example, the distinction between fake and authentic news will continue to be a contentious issue. It's doubtful that anything substantive can be done through legislation or education. So look for apps that help you distinguish between facts and opinions. While these may technologically function properly, it's unlikely they'll have any real effect. Perhaps it's just human nature that we're attracted to whatever confirms our biases and repelled by anything that casts doubt on them. Other trends that will have a direct influence on American innovation include the decreasing growth rates in China, the overheated stock market, and how our new nationalism affects our ability to attract and retain world-class talent. We still need places to sell our solutions, money to finance them, and bright and creative people to develop them. Some things never change. Here's hoping 2017 will be our most innovative year ever.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up, should we be surprised so many retail outlets are closing their brick-and-mortar stores in Michigan?
Physical stores are not going away, but what we're seeing now is the outcome of basically being an overstored country for a really long time.
That's in 5 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Flint residents packed a town hall meeting last night to get a progress report on their water. As EPA official Robert Kaplan told us on Wednesday's Stateside, an array of scientific tests and data show the water is improving. But as people heard last night from the EPA and state officials, Flint's tap water is not safe to drink unless it's been run through a filter. Congressman Dan Kildee had to be in Washington for confirmation hearings, but he did have staff at the town hall, and he watched it from D.C. Congressman, what did you take away from last night's meeting?
Well, I think it's important that the agencies at the federal and state level are very clear and very transparent. And they did, I think, make an attempt to make sure that the information they had was delivered to the people of Flint in a way that they can understand it. There are concerns about the extent of that transparency. And I just call on those officials to continue to err on the side of clarity and transparency, because the loss of trust is one of the consequences of the water crisis. And one of the only ways to rebuild that is to be absolutely truthful about everything.
What didn't you hear last night?
In some ways, the difficulty is that it's often the case that these officials speak in terminology and lingo and sort of very scientific language. What people need to hear is, you know, in terms that they can completely decipher, can I drink this water? When will I be able to? What should I be doing to protect my family? And I think, to be fair, EPA officials and others are doing that. But people are, it's going to take a while before the citizens of Flint actually trust that. So they just need to stick with it and keep being as honest as possible with the people of Flint. And it's a tough thing, but they're going to have to do it, especially when the news is that we're not through this yet. This crisis is not over. And I was very concerned that there would be an attempt to sort of sugarcoat these facts. They really didn't do that, but again, I think they need to speak in plain English.
I also understand that there was a kind of a gentle but firm protest from people regarding crinkling water bottles.
Right. And I think people have a right to express themselves, and it's important that those officials understand the frustration. And so when there were these assurances being provided or more sort of positive news that was being delivered, citizens were crinkling those water bottles. And I think the message I take from that is Yeah, we heard this before, and we are still drinking bottled water. You know, we were told the water was safe before. And you know, I hope that federal and state officials especially understand that even when they're telling the truth and they're being clear, it's going to take time before the people of Flint can trust that. And they just need to have some patience, because the people of Flint were told the water was safe when the state government knew it was not. And it's going to take time before they can trust that.
Flint Democratic Representative Dan Kildee. Congressman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
All right. Thank you.
The holiday decorations had barely been taken down when a harsh verdict was passed on the holiday shopping season. Macy's announced it's closing 68 stores across the country. Here in Michigan, that means Macy's stores in Lansing, Battle Creek, Harper Woods, and Westland are closing. Then we hear Sears is closing 150 of its Kmart and Sears stores, 10 in Michigan, including the very first Kmart in Garden City. And Walmart says it's cutting hundreds of jobs by month's end. Tough times for brick-and-mortar retailers. Well, let's find out as we say hello to Patricia Huddleston, a professor of retailing at Michigan State University. Were you surprised by these announcements?
Actually, no. Well, with the exception of the Walmart labor cuts, yes, a little bit surprised at that. But no, I'm not surprised at the store closings. And actually, Macy's had announced 100 store closings earlier last year. So, you know, that was not a surprise. And then Sears has been hanging by a thread for quite some time. So, again, that those store closings are not at all a surprise.
And as Macy's announced this latest round of closings, which we should note will be wiping out 10,000 jobs, it pointed to a disappointing holiday shopping season. But this is really more than one bad season, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Although, if you look at the big picture, actually overall holiday sales were pretty robust this year and about on target with what the National Retail Federation predicted, which was about a 3.5% upward trend in sales. But that doesn't necessarily mean that every single retailer reaped those benefits.
And when we say sales, are we including online?
We are including online.
Which leads to the question, what are we seeing in consumer behavior bringing us to this point?
Consumers are increasingly shopping online, and part of that is motivated by mobile shopping. So most consumers now have access to a smartphone, be it an Apple iPhone or a Samsung or some other type of phone. And so sales via mobile are actually increasing even more quickly than traditional online sales. And the convenience of that, the ability to compare prices, and the ability to shop anytime are three things that are motivating consumers online shopping.
Well, I mean, you think about it, it's real easy to sit in your PJs and sip a cup of coffee and click away, shop online. You're not fighting for a parking spot or driving to and from, which tells us what about the future of department stores and indeed malls?
Well, what it tells us is that any retailers that want to attract consumers into the store need to create a wonderful shopping experience. And there are retailers that have done that. If you look at some of the specialty retailers, you know, just pulling an example out of my head, like Cabela's, for example, which is, you know, a mega sporting goods and outdoor merchandise retailer, and they provide a really interesting shopping environment, really good sales assistance, and, you know, plenty of parking and that type of thing. So physical stores are not going away, but what we're seeing now is the outcome of basically being an overstored country for a really long time. Just in thinking about the amount of retail space per capita, the United States right now has about 25 square feet of retail space per capita versus Canada, which is about half that at 13. So we just have too much space, and our population is not growing quickly enough to absorb the demand.
Well, I think about something that I've watched from I grew up in Oakland County. And we shopped at Northland. And it's so interesting to realize that Hudson's was reluctant to have branch stores, but it was an architect that convinced Hudson's, no, ring downtown Detroit with these three branch stores and malls, Northland, Eastland, and Westland. And those branches helped doom the downtown stores, and the Hudson's name is no more. But it's amazing to think the Northland store, which was by then a Macy's, shut down in March 2015, and now the mall is gone, going to be leveled. And these latest closings have claimed the Macy's at Eastland and Westland. So it's kind of gone full circle.
It has. And depending on the mall and depending on whether there are more than one anchor at a mall, losing an anchor like a Macy's can sort of ring the death knell for a mall, because it's becoming more and more difficult to find a comparable anchor tenant that is going to draw the traffic. And so that's why it's so, I guess it's so important to look at, you know, who those anchors are and where, you know, I guess where the next one is going to come from.
We're talking about brick and mortar retailers and the malls of America as we talk with Patricia Huddleston, a professor of retailing at Michigan State University. So here we're seeing this growing trend, as you say, mobile shopping. People can go pick up, whip out their phone, click, click, for example, pay for Amazon Prime and you get the free 2-day shipping. What's not to love about that from the convenience point of view? But what are people who do not have access to online shopping? What are the options for them? And where are they going, particularly as we see these stores closing down?
Well, and that's a really interesting question, and one that I don't believe has been investigated. And actually, your question sort of sparked an interest in my own mind. But the short answer is that people that do not have access to online and where malls are closing down, they are just going to have to travel further to meet their basic needs, or they're going to have to, you know, sort of gear up, learn computers, get online, and, you know, sort of join in. But for the elderly, for example, I'm not sure that that's a realistic expectation. And so what happens for these more marginalized groups is that shopping is going to be more cumbersome. It's going to cost more because, you know, there are travel and time costs involved in going further to a mall. And I'm not sure that that problem has really been investigated or addressed appropriately.
I have seen stories that ask this question, is the department store dead? What is your answer to that?
Oh, that's a hard question. They have been predicting the demise of department stores for decades, literally. And with every ebb and flow of trends, it's, you know, it's predicted again and again. I think some department stores are struggling, but if you look at stores like Neiman Marcus, granted it's an upscale specialty department store, they're doing well. Nordstrom's is doing well. And actually Macy's, from a digital standpoint, has been recognized in the industry as doing everything right. And so what Macy's is doing right now is closing unproductive retail stores. And, you know, I wish I had a crystal ball to be able to predict the future, but I think that this may be a way to strengthen Macy's, and they may come out of this okay.
Well, interesting to kind of think about what has happened and what will come. What do you see in the future for retail in America, Patricia?
I see that online shopping is going to continue to increase, and I see that technology at the point of purchase, so in-store, is going to be a way to engage consumers. And I think that retailers that really want to survive need to look at how consumers shop, make it convenient for the customer. That's the key. And the other really interesting thing, you know, a lot of the retailers that are doing the online pickup in store, actually what they're finding is that a lot of the customers will then actually go and shop. So, you know, any time that you can get the customer into the store is going to be a win-win situation. It may not happen every time, but to me that's the key, is to meld the online and the in-store experience.
Patricia Huddleston, professor of retailing at Michigan State University. I always love talking shopping, so appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
All right, Cynthia, my pleasure.
If you have fished or wanted to fish or thought about fishing or just stepped out of doors with some sense of expectancy, Body of Water is the book for you. Though Montana is his home now, Michigan poets know Chris Dombrowski from his elegant poetry collection, Earth Again, published by Wayne State University Press. Michigan anglers know Chris as a stellar fly fishing guide. As part of our ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark, author Gloria Whelan has this review.
Body of Water, a sage, a seeker, and the world's most alluring fish, takes Dombrowski to a new and distant place. In the middle of a Montana winter, he is offered a fishing trip to the Grand Bahamas. All expenses paid. It's an easy choice. His wife sends him off with this advice: be where you are. He finds himself in a place unlike any he has known. How better to learn a country than to fish it? He soon hears the story of David Pinder, a native of the island, who grew up with his 11 siblings in a two-room home. Pinder, the sage in the book's title, made his living as a young man gathering sponges and lugging rocks in construction work. In his spare time, he was fishing for bonefish, then a little-known sport. The bonefish is a puzzle. Not overly large, not very tasty, but a fighter, quick, difficult to see, and hellish to land, testing the skill and the stamina of the angler. Dombrowski describes its elusiveness. The shadow of the fish nearly always more visible than its body, its scales varying in hue from moment to match its environment. Pinder was taken on as a guide for a rustic camp, Deepwater Key. That was 40 years ago. Deepwater Key has grown to be one of the world's most fabled sporting lodges. Bone fishing is now an annual $141 million crop, its impact on the island enormous. And talking about Pinder, Dombrowski also talks about the relationship between guide and patron and what hiring means when two anglers are side by side, focused on a mutual goal. But Dombrowski reminds us that when something goes wrong, it's always the guide's fault. Pinder himself says, no matter how quiet a guide gets, he always wants to catch fish more, far more than his client does. Dombrowski returned to the Bahamas and became friends with the owners of Deepwater Key, as well as the elderly Pinder, now retired and with little money left. In a talk recently in the Ann Arbor bookstore Literati, Dombrowski called Pinder the most holy man I have ever met. Attempting to tell Pinder's story, Dombrowski says, is like the persistence of the horizon. You take one step toward it, and it takes one step back. Precisely, where does the water stop and the sky begin? Lines between biography, story, and myth seem even less definable, more arbitrary. Ever since the days of Isaac Walton, the angler has attempted to express his love of fishing. Dombrowski quotes Meister Eckhart, the 13th century mystic, "Meditation is our far country, and we return from our solitudes with kingdoms, but allow these kingdoms to be usurped by our worldly desires." Fishing, Dombrowski says, is a perfect job for those who prefer talking to themselves to talking to others. He reminds us the Buddha said, "Days spent fishing do not count against one's allotted days." Body of Water tells us why.
Gloria Whelan won the National Book Award for her young adult novel, Homeless Bird. Her fiction has appeared in Prize Stories, O. Henry Awards, and her short story collection, Living Together, was a Foreword Review finalist, and it received the 2014 Ippi Silver Medal in the Short Story Fiction Award. You can hear her review of Chris Dombrowski's Body of Water and find other book reviews on our website, michiganradio.org. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, we will get the latest from the North American International Auto Show. And then, Election Day 2016 was hard on Democrats. Now comes rebuilding and the governor's race in 2018.
We're going to be crystal clear about our emphasis on making sure that we are the party of working people and people looking to get ahead, not the party of big corporations and others who've rigged the system to their advantage.
A conversation with State Democratic Chair Brandon Dillon. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Reporters from around the world have spent this week checking out the offerings at the North American International Auto Show. Saturday morning, the doors at Cobo open to the public, so it's our turn. Paul Eisenstein is the publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. And Paul, I know you've seen it all this week, so I'd like your tips for everyone going to the show. What are the top models people should not miss?
Well, there's a whole bunch, and it really depends on what you're looking for, because you're seeing a lot from makers around the world, and you're seeing a lot in very different product segments. Before I answer you more directly, we're in the midst of probably one of the most important transformations that we have seen in the auto industry in decades, the transformation from cars to light trucks. Crossovers, SUVs, pickups, vans, they account for almost two-thirds of the market these days. So not surprisingly, you're seeing a lot more of those vehicles and fewer sedans, coupes, and the like at the show than you had in previous years. Now, that said, there are some interesting passenger cars. You'll see a brand new version of the Audi A5 convertible, or cabriolet as they like to call it. One of the most exciting vehicles at the show was the Kia Stinger, Kia's first sports car. It's what we in the business like to call a GT or Gran Turismo. But I've heard even some of the competition wildly praise the design. It's a beautiful vehicle and worth checking out. BMW has a number of passenger cars over there, including a plug-in hybrid version of their Big 7 series. And you're going to see a lot of electrified vehicles, everything from plain hybrids all the way up to full battery electric vehicles. You can't miss the production version of the Chevrolet Bolt. See, even I do that problem. The Chevrolet Bolt with a B, EV. So make sure to stop by there.
The car of the year.
Yes, it was. And I'm on the North American Car of the Year jury, and I'm glad to say that I picked that one. But you will see a tremendous number of utes, or SUVs and CUVs, and from just about every manufacturer you can think of. Audi shows how much the industry is changing. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to get a flagship vehicle, you got a big, you know, full-size sedan like the Audi A8 or Mercedes S-Class. Well, they're showing off the Audi Q8, Q being their shorthand for a utility vehicle, and that is going to be their new flagship. Chevrolet has the Traverse, and one of the big surprises was the debut of the Bronco, an old name on a new SUV coming from Ford Motor Company.
We know that this is the first official auto show of the season, but there kind of was an unofficial auto show last week in Las Vegas in the Consumer Electronics Show because FCA was there.
Yeah, and in fact, there's a lot of talk going on right now about the fact that CES is in many ways cutting in on the Detroit Auto Show. Some people are wondering whether Detroit will have to blink and perhaps move a little bit later or even earlier in the model year. We'll have to wait and see on that. It is still a very important Detroit Auto Show, but there's no question that CES was very important, and for good reason. The car is becoming a computer on wheels. The lines between the auto industry and the technology industry are blurring very rapidly. As a result, a number of automakers are going out to Las Vegas for CES each year to talk about their high technology gear, but they're also launching some products out there. The Bolt was launched there a year ago, and this year we saw a concept from Chrysler called the Portal, which we're now hearing they will actually put into production. It's, if you will, a minivan for the millennial generation.
We saw pictures of that, and that looked fascinating. Speaking of FCA, we've got to talk about some new news today. The EPA accusing FCA of violating the Clean Air Act with some of its diesel engines. FCA's stock dropped more than 12% after that announcement. What can you tell us?
Well, there have been a lot of rumors that Fiat Chrysler might have been rigging, or at least stretching the rules when it came to their new diesels. They're using them in a number of vehicles, including the big Ram 1500 pickup and the Jeep Grand Cherokee. So far, it wasn't clear, wasn't proven, but now it appears the EPA has some hard evidence that may be some serious trouble for them, especially if they are found to have played the same sort of games that Volkswagen did. You know, we just saw this week VW hit with yet another $4.3 billion fine while six executives were indicted. We don't know what the EPA is saying will lead to the same level of legal problems for Fiat Chrysler. In fact, it's yet to be proven that the EPA data is right. But I've got to tell you, if I were either working for FCA or a shareholder, I'd be worried.
Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, thanks for talking with us. Always great to talk with you and get the latest.
My pleasure. Thanks.
If you're a Democrat, the November election produced a pretty tough outcome. So now what? How do Democrats regroup, recalibrate, and rebuild? Let's find out from the chairman of Michigan's Democratic Party, Brandon Dillon. Welcome to Stateside.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You were quoted in a recent Associated Press story that I saw in the Washington Post, and here was your quote. We've lost governorships and state legislatures at a rate that is pretty astounding. And why do you think this Democratic message and the candidates failed to connect with voters?
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that. You know, we had a very high point in 2008 when President Obama was elected. We controlled a lot of the state legislatures that we currently don't control, had a majority of governorships. 2010 really turned out to be a terrible year for us at the worst time possible, at a time when redistricting was coming to pass, and Republicans were very adept at manipulating the lines to guarantee an advantage. In the meantime, I think as Democrats, we took our eye off the ball. Having the White House took it for granted and didn't do the kind of investment, building, and organizational efforts we need to do in state parties and local parties. Republicans did a good job of really focusing on those down ballot races to be able to cement control of state houses, state senates, governorships. And we really need to do the same thing now that we are out of power, not only in Michigan, but essentially in Washington. We've got to really reinvest and rebuild from the ground up at the state party level. And we do have a unique opportunity to do it with the kind of energy that we've seen post-election, people very frustrated and angry and want to get involved. And that's what we intend to do.
It's a major energizer, isn't it, to have a shellacking like that?
It certainly is. I mean, you know, look, we obviously would have liked to see a different result in November. And the fact that Secretary Clinton was able to carry the popular vote by almost 3 million votes, I think, suggests that, you know, while we may be down, we're certainly not out. This is a party that nationally our message does resonate. And in some key states like Michigan and other states in the industrial Midwest, I think we have to do a better job of making sure that we're talking to people year round, not just right at election time, and make sure that our message is a little bit tighter so that people understand that we really are the party of working people, working families, and people that are struggling to survive in a system that is really rigged towards people at the top.
The Republicans got their voters out. Democratic turnout was down. Do you think it was because of the message or the messenger?
You know, I think it takes a little while after an election to actually really determine that. I do think the fact that the campaign was so brutally negative from beginning to end, I remember talking to people back in January about what the campaign was going to look like. And I said, don't expect this to be an uplifting affair like we saw in 2008. This was a real slugfest. It got ugly. It got nasty. You had the FBI. You had all sorts of allegations involved, most of which were not true. But I think part of it is the message. We allowed Donald Trump to take a message that Democrats have been able to own for years about being on the side of working families and people that are in the middle class. And he wrapped it up in a healthy dose of racism and sexism and real kind of ugliness. But at its core, it's a message that we would be foolish not to try to recapture. And that's that we are the party. Our candidates are the ones that are fighting for average people, while Donald Trump and Republicans are putting billionaires and millionaires in key positions and ensuring that the system that makes it difficult for working people to get ahead is going to continue.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with the chairman of Michigan's Democratic Party, Brandon Dillon. I'm wondering what thoughts you have about the Democratic National Committee and the support it gave to down-ballot candidates. Was that a satisfying effort from your point of view?
Having only been chair for less than 2 years, I see it from both the perspective of somebody who's been on the inside and then also as a state legislator on the outside. I think the DNC needs to get back to what it did back when Howard Dean was chair, frankly, with the 50-state strategy and investing in state parties. When you hold the White House, the DNC kind of by default becomes a political arm of the president and is geared towards supporting the agenda of the White House. Now that we don't control the White House, we really have to refocus the DNC's efforts on making sure that we are getting the support in states like Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, frankly, every other state in the country where there's an opportunity for Democrats to win at all levels of government. We are talking with all the candidates for DNC and are very encouraged that all of them really seem to have the same message that the DNC has to change its culture, and it has to be more involved throughout the entire election cycle from beginning to end on empowering and helping us groom candidates, find volunteers, and rebuild our strength on the ground.
There are five candidates hoping to become the next DNC chair, and I'm wondering, have you made your choice?
I'm getting pretty close to doing that. Probably will be making a choice here in the next week or so, but this is really a positive campaign that's been going on for all the candidates. They are all talking about, to varying degrees, reinstituting that 50-state strategy, looking at Michigan as a real tier one battleground state, which I think is critically important. We were never considered that up until, I think, unfortunately, the results of this election, and making sure that whoever the DNC chair is understands that in order to rebuild power, it's not going to come from Washington. It's going to come from places like Lansing and Detroit and Macomb County, Monroe County.
We have seen a Democrat get the jump on every other possible candidate for governor in our state. Gretchen Whitmer says she is all in. What do you see as her strengths as a candidate?
Well, you know, I've known Gretchen for a long time when I was a staffer in the Senate and she was a state rep, and then serving as colleagues when I was in the state house. She's an incredibly talented communicator. She has a really strong personality and is somebody who really fights for the things she believes in. I'm looking forward to making sure that we have a very vigorous and strong primary. I suspect we haven't seen all of the candidates get in yet, but I think not only Gretchen, but some of the other names that have been mentioned would be extremely qualified candidates for governor, and more importantly, would be a huge improvement over what we've seen in the last 7 years with this administration.
Who are some of the other names that you're hearing and you're saying, yep, I'd like to see that happen?
Well, I don't think it's any secret. Congressman Kildee is exploring a run, and you know, he has been extremely effective in advocating for the residents of the people in Flint, and also making a very strong case about why this philosophy of government that Governor Snyder has put upon the people of Michigan of running the state like a business is an utter and total failure. He's extremely bright, he's extremely hardworking, and you know, from the party's perspective, we are just happy that the people that are putting their names forward or are likely to put their names forward for governor are extremely high quality candidates. We don't have any energy that we have to expend this year on going out and recruiting candidates. We have high quality people who know what's at stake and I think are going to do what it takes to make sure that we have a primary that's about issues and about who can better move the state forward and really turn around this failed experiment in government that we've seen from Governor Snyder and other Republicans.
And speaking of redistricting, we know the governor who's elected in 2018 is going to be at the helm when the districts are redrawn in 2020. So that has to be just a we're going to the mattresses kind of fight for you.
To say it's critically important that Democrats win the governor's office in 2018, I think would be an understatement. We are going to do everything possible to make sure that we have a Democratic governor sworn in January of 2019 to not only make sure that we have a strong role in redistricting, but that we have the ability to start moving a more positive agenda for our schools, to make sure that we have tax fairness and not rigging the system in favor of corporations at the expense of seniors and others who've seen their expenses rise while the services and the value they're getting from government decline precipitously. We are going to put a lot of effort into supporting our Democratic nominee, and I think there's an incredible energy on the ground of people who understand what's at stake and are going to do everything possible to help make sure we're successful in that endeavor.
You're running for re-election as the state party chairman. I know the convention's coming up on February 11th. What do you say to people who think, well, you know, last November's stinging defeat might be a sign that it could be good to have someone new at the helm of the party? What's your answer to that?
Sure. Well, I certainly share people's frustrations in the results of the election. I can tell you from, you know, my experience, we worked very hard to elect Secretary Clinton and to focus on our state house races. You know, what we saw in Michigan was similar to what we saw in states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio, where there was a group of voters who I don't think many of us anticipated turning out in support of Donald Trump and really turning against our candidates in the last 2 weeks. The numbers we were looking at gave us cautious optimism that we were going to be successful. But, you know, I think the thing that I'm trying to focus on is to say we also have an opportunity now to engage in a partnership with the Democratic National Committee and all these new activists who've really been excited not only by the campaign of Senator Sanders last year, but about the prospects of rebuilding this party from the ground up. We are going to focus aggressively on getting back to basics and making sure that the Democratic Party in Michigan is a party that reflects grassroots activists in our state and the priorities that they share. We're going to be rebuilding in 2017 and talking to voters and not waiting until just before the election and build a foundation for whoever our candidate for governor and other statewide offices is can capitalize on. I hope people who share that vision will support me at the convention. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to hopefully continue to serve.
Chairman Dillon, as you talk with other Democrats, especially in the wake of what happened last November on Election Day, do Democrats have any kind of feeling or sense that the very survival of the party is at stake here?
Well, I do think people understand that, you know, we are in a pretty tough situation. You've been in a tough situation for a long time. I think this most recent election, I think, brought it into much sharper focus. People, I don't think, expected the results that we have. In fact, I don't think anybody, if they're being honest, expected, even on the Republican side, the results that we ultimately had on November 8th. But I do think, you know, that kind of concern also breeds a certain energy and a commitment to making sure that we do the things necessary in 2017 to make sure that we're successful in 2018 and beyond. And to the extent that we can harness the energy of the people who've signed up for the party, who are looking to get involved, we are going to make sure that those people are not left sitting on the bench wondering what they can do to help not only change the party, but change our state. We're going to give them things to do, and we're going to listen to them to make sure that the message that we're delivering, not only from the state party, but through our candidates, is one that more accurately reflects the values that we actually care about and is one that voters can really grasp onto. We're going to be crystal clear about our emphasis on making sure that we are the party of working people and people looking to get ahead, not the party of big corporations and others who've rigged the system to their advantage.
Brandon Dillon, chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party. Thank you so much for spending time with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Josh Hakala, and Cass Adair. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.